Looking for an audio escape to put your mind at ease? Landscapes by Dune is a musical journey through sampling and field recording. From the busy streets of Toronto to BC's picturesque landscapes, the Belgian artist recorded an array of sounds during his travels across Canada. Landscapes will be released on Pop Guitari Records Bandcamp on December 8th and will be available on all streaming platforms on December 15th. For more information, check out at Dune as Dune on Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.
My feelings are a tender thread. I'm trying not to get ahead of this. To get ahead. It's clear. Halfway home. I'm clear. Halfway home when I look at you.
Welcome back to the Arts Report on CITR 101.9 FM. Today is Wednesday, October 16th, and we are broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia Vancouver campus, which is unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. Indigenous voices in so-called Canada have been systematically devalued and diminished, and this cannot go unacknowledged in broadcast media such as radio. To hear more, please listen to Unceded Airwaves from CITR's Indigenous Collective. All right, so we have a very packed show today. I'm in the studio with Django and Lily, if you guys want to say hi.
Hello.
Hey.
So, yeah, we're going to be talking about VIF and VOF, which is the Vancouver Outsiders Arts Festival, and wrapping up our discussion about that. We also have a special Halloween episode coming out in 2 weeks, and I'm going to give like a little sneak peek that we're also going to be having an exhibition with The Hatch in early November. So stay tuned with that. More details to be announced. So without any further ado, Django, do you want to talk about your lovely VIF interview?
Yes. So I interviewed the director, Sukyun Lee, who not only directing, she's done a ton of other stuff in like broadcasting. And she was an actress, or she's an actress as well. So I got to sit down and interview her. Her film Paying for It came out at TIFF this year, but was playing at VIF this year. And I got to sit down with her and Chester Brown, who's a cartoonist who wrote the book that the movie is based off of. And it's based off of their life and what happened after they separated pretty much.
They were in like a romantic relationship, right?
Yeah, romantic relationship. And then the film kind of takes off as that ends. And we get into it a bit in the interview, and it was pretty fun.
Awesome. Yeah. So we're going to go straight into this interview here. Thank you so much, Django. This is Sukyun Lee from Paying for It.
By film director, actress, artist, broadcaster, and Vancouver's very own Sukyun Lee.
Yay!
Whose film Paying for It, based on the graphic novel of the same name, was written by my other guest, the cartoonist Chester Brown, is playing at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Thank you so much for joining me here on the show.
Thanks for having us, Django.
Yeah, it's great to be here. And thank you for acknowledging that I'm from Vancouver.
Yeah. The graphic novel comes out in 2011. Why 13 years later did you decide that the story is the one that needs to be shared on the big screen?
Well, it took that long for me to get it right on the page.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Chester's book came out in 2011. I always knew that he's one of the best storytellers in the world. And 2011, Chester Brown, great storyteller. I see the book. I'm like, holy smokes, this is rocking my world, because not only do I know Chester and I admire the fact that being such a shy, introverted person, he had the sort of courage to go out and explore paying for sex. Even if I ever wanted to, I'd never have the boldness to be able to do that. And then on top of that, to reiterate and write down his experiences, and you know, not only was it interesting, his own personal exploration, but that he sort of parlayed his memoir to illuminate the lack of rights consensual sex workers are afforded in this society was a terrible travesty that, to me, said everything about the lack of sex worker rights, but also it spoke about labor rights and women's rights and human rights. And to me, that was an important utility. So I just, you know, I stood in line behind a few other really top-notch filmmakers and hoped that I could adapt it. And I'll pass it.
Yeah. After the book was published, I was approached by a few directors and some production companies, you know, approached me too. And I just didn't trust anyone because, you know, it's such a personal book, and the people's attitudes towards sex work, I just didn't know if they, you know, any particular producer or director would have the right take on sex work, even if they thought they would from reading the book. So I was saying no to all these film offers, and I was talking to Sukian about it, and she said, well, if you're going to be saying no to those people, like, what about me? Like, I'd be interested in directing it. And that seemed like such the perfect option. You know, she was a director. I knew her work and knew it was great. And she was a part of the story, and we were good friends. So it seemed like the obvious choice.
And like, speaking of the depiction of sex work in this movie, it's a very like humanizing take on these individuals who are participating in it, which I feel like is so rare to see in media. I just wondered if you'd like to like comment on that a bit, because that, like, as a viewer, was a very impactful part.
Oh, that's wonderful to hear. Yeah.
In the book, I avoided showing a lot about the sex workers because in my interactions with them, they actually revealed a lot about their lives. I mean, I'm sure they held a lot back too. But, you know, they might talk about previous jobs, or maybe their stuff with going on with their boyfriends, or growing up details, whatever. And all of this would have been terrific material to put in the book, but I knew I couldn't, because all that would be too revealing. So they probably in the book come across not as fully three-dimensional, fleshed out characters the way they perhaps should have. Whereas Sukian, in my book, I was trying to be as honest as possible in the book and not, you know, not fictionalize stuff. Whereas Sukian wanted to show them as real people, and so she was willing to fictionalize the depictions of them.
Yeah, I mean, Chester's book, and I should probably go back a couple paces. We were a couple, so we were a romantic couple. And his choice to pay for sex came after the romantic aspects of our relationship began to fade. And I was really young and kind of developing. I developed a crush on someone, and we always had a very open relationship in terms of talking to one another. And I didn't want to pursue that before talking to Chester about it. So I was like, okay, so what do you think? I'm curious about this person, and I have feelings for this person. What do you say? And you know, he's a person who is truly a lover of people's rights and freedoms, so long as you're not hurting another person. And so he kind of lives by that credo. He really does not appreciate the kind of coercion of institutional and governmental overreach into our lives. And so he really, on a personal level, really reveres freedom of the individual, of the person to do, pursue that which they want. So when I brought that up, you know, even though that was a challenging situation, it was like, well, if that's what you feel like, let's talk about it. So that actually was the impetus for his graphic novel. It begins with our kind of like, what if we open it up? Okay, let's try. I said, okay, we made this negotiation. I pursued the culturally sanctioned route of dating, carelessly so. And he was celibate for a long time. And when he couldn't be celibate anymore, he was not interested in flirting or having another relationship. So then he began to, what about paying for sex? And so that was sort of the beginning of his graphic novel. And then his novel really was myopically from his perspective, again, trying to protect the details, the confidentiality of the sex workers he had visited, as well as with me, I'm a character in the book. His friends are as well. He treaded very lightly on revealing any details. When I read the book, I was like, wow, you really didn't mention very much about our life together, because we are living together through these as for years as we were pursuing these very different ends to love, connection, and sex. And he was like, yeah, I was just trying to protect you. And so even when I was adapting the book, he wouldn't divulge the details because his protection goes truly to the end. He's not going to tell me and spill the beans for this. So then I was like, okay, I'm going to have to look for clues in the source material, in the graphic novel. There are details. And then use my imagination, do my due diligence research, speak with sex workers, hear their perspectives. I have worked in sex work adjacent fields, although I'm not a sex worker proper, but I felt that, you know, if I could expand the canvas of Chester's story to include what was happening in our lives, sort of boil down his most cogent points of his political treatise, and then also sort of distill particular sex workers that could articulate how Chester was transforming, then I could sort of change it from a graphic novel to a movie. So it's very different. Like, he sees way more sex workers in the graphic novel, and it's much more episodic and kind of more of a political tract. And in kind of Chester really kind of, he's very restrained and doesn't necessarily project his emotions on his narrative. So it has a tendency to feel a little bit more kind of logical. And some people see it as like less heart engaged, maybe cold, has been described. Whereas I know Chester as one of the warmest, most fanciful, thoughtful, caring angels in my life. That was completely not there in the book. I mean, when I read it, I knew, I projected my knowledge of him. So of course I thought, oh, it's so sweet. Whereas most people are like, is he Asperger's? Is he autistic? Like, they profoundly weird understandings of him, but I know otherwise, and wanted to imbibe Chester with those qualities that I know of him so well, as well as imbibe. I couldn't just have, you know, the women's heads not in the frame.
Yeah, in the book, I don't even show the women's faces. Mm-hmm.
For fear of revealing characteristics of their physicality.
Of course.
Yeah, so that was a challenge, because I would beg, tell me anything, throw me a bone. Nope.
Yeah, she was particularly, as you've seen the film, so you know that there's one particular sex worker who's significantly featured, this mm-hmm. this woman who is
Ulyssa Denise.
Ulyssa Denise. And Sukin was begging me for real details about Denise.
Sometimes I would be very try to use my, you know, journalistic wiles to, like, you know, try to sneakily ask, but he always sniffed it up. No. So it was through speaking with people like Valerie Scott, who is a really outstanding sex worker advocate. She went to the Supreme Court of Canada with two other sex workers to strike down anti-prostitution laws and won. And she shared not only political aspects, but also relational aspects of the work. Unfortunately, what happened when they won in the Supreme Court of Canada, the government made a new law and criminalized the Johns instead. So it was a hollow victory, and we're still in a place where consensual sex workers are subhumans in our society and not afford basic human rights, which is something that is challenging. So, yeah, very important to bring those people to life. As well, Andrea Wehrhahn, who's one of the lead actors in the movie, she's a longtime collaborator of Chester's. She came out with a book, Modern Horror, which she made into a short film that Chester starred in as a John and designed the poster for, and she's currently working on a feature movie of modern horror. So she was the story consultant on our movie, the lead actor, as well as a story consultant on Anora, which is another sex work positive film that's part of like a current small zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. We are just simply scratching the surface. Anora is from the perspective of a sex worker. Paying for it is from the perspective of a John, both very, you know, non-existent in pop culture and the media. So nuanced portrayals.
I wouldn't say that sex workers and their clients are non-existent, but their depiction, shall we say, has problems. So often, like, clients of sex workers are depicted as like crazy maniacs, like serial killers or whatever.
Or very ugly mouth breathers or manipulative, brutal, violent. Yeah.
The nuance is taken out of it, essentially.
Yeah, it's totally taken out. And I'm sure there are Johns that are terrible. Mm-hmm, but there are many Johns that are, you know, Chester's a pretty good John. I think probably most sex workers are like, oh, he's on the scale of like Johns, he's very, very good. So I think it's just like, yeah, the sort of demystifying and also humanizing. So whereas Chester's was primarily a political piece that really spoke to me, I knew that in making this, I would have to sort of embrace those politics, but really kind of obscure the tracks. I wasn't really interested in doing a didactic movie. I wanted to make a movie that had transformation of character, fun, mm-hmm. you know, about love and relationships and care and intimacy. And so, yeah, I think it was a combination of his astute kind of academic, historic, logical mind, and then my sort of hot-headedness, emotionalism. I love a relationship. I love to laugh. You know, we both love to laugh. Yours is very funny, too. So, yeah, I think the movie is really a combo.
Speaking of the human aspect of it, I noticed that you said in an interview when you were interviewing celebrities, you were trying to want to take away that celebrity mythos of
totally.
Them and strip them down to humans. Do you find that connect in a lot of what you do?
Yes. I mean, I think that I've had a couple of lucky situations in my life. And one of them was getting my first kind of real job was working as a VJ on Much Music. And very quickly seeing celebrity after celebrity after celebrity come into the environment and interview and seeing their humbled human being qualities, very quickly celebrity demystified for me. And I've always been very interested in people that don't have access to the media. Mm-hmm. So while I was interviewing celebrities, I would always have a camera in my bag. And if I met somebody extraordinary in real life, oftentimes I'd interview them, be it a squeegee kid who was living in a tent with a bunch of guys in a back alley in the middle of winter, you know, and then put him beside John Bon Jovi, you know, like, so really even the playing field. Mm-hmm. I actually found non-celebrities much more interesting than celebrities. So yeah, I'm really glad I had that. And I'm also like, I was raised in Lynn Valley and I'm like first gen Chinese Canadian. And I saw my parents struggle from poverty and wishing for a lot of wealth. And I saw that striving for wealth to be painful for my mom and ultimately damaging. And so I was lucky to be raised in a way that made me anti-materialistic and also kind of not anti-celebrity, but not so excited about celebrities. It's just very real. It's like there's a lot of baloney in our society. So very lucky as a young person to have had those experiences that allowed me to learn how kind of hollow those things are.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess going back to like who being represented as characters in this film, in the film, your character's name has been changed to Sunny. How like early on did you decide where maybe I don't want my full name to be attached to this like character?
Yeah, pretty early on. In fact, I did a fabrication name of Chester's, and Chester's like, just use my name. Oh. I'm like, okay, good, I will. And I tried my best to uphold the essential essence of how he is portrayed in his memoir. And I think I've developed those skills as a broadcaster. So as a documentarian and a journalist, like what you're doing, mm-hmm. what we do is we record raw material, hours of raw material, and our job is to distill to a nugget the ingredients. And if we're doing our jobs well, we're able to identify the essence of the person and serve that essence, albeit in a smaller kind of golden nugget. Mm-hmm. So the same kind of quality of, I took your work and tried to distill it down to what that was. And whereas with me, I didn't want to say Sukyun because I knew that I would be taking everything that occurs to her comes from a seed of experience and reality. Again, I didn't want to pin it exactly like my life, but sort of use elements of my life in order to craft a story. So I knew that it would be more in the realm of autofiction, my portrayal. And I knew that the portrayal would be different in the hands of the actor who embodied me. So in this case, Emily Lay, it's a combination of, you know, real life, what Emily brings to it, and then me fictionalizing aspects of what had occurred to me in order to fit the story. And I guess what the reason why it worked well to incorporate me as a character was I kind of embodied the sort of perspective of, you know, romantic possessive monogamy, which is a culturally approved version of seeking love and connection and sex in our society.
Yes.
Whereas Chester, his whole journey was representative of the socially unacceptable way. So this is a argument in Chester's thing, a predominant argument. So to have us both having that is sort of as a way to embody it in action and character.
Yeah, I think that comes across that very wonderfully in the film too. Oh, also, I'm like nerding out fully here, but there's the relation between the scene of the in the beginning of the movie on the bed and then the towels at the end, and that to like with the I can't
the
remember.
Towel?
You're lying on the beach
when you're in Costa Rica. Or
yes,
whatever,
yes, Costa Rica. Yes. Yeah.
Well, yeah. There's many kind of visual. There's many on the surface. It's a simple, sweethearted movie about relationships. That has provocative things, but then there are many nuances and many Easter eggs in the film.
Easter, I noticed maybe one Easter egg from an earlier movie of yours in there with a certain mascot.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's like...
Tell how Emily made that costume.
Oh, yeah, Emily saw my first film, Escapades of the One Particular Mr. Noodle, that was based on real life. As I walked the streets of the West End dressed as a 10-foot egg noodle, it's up on YouTube for free to watch. And she wasn't working that day when we were doing the comic book convention scene. And then I go to the set and she's there. She's made a perfect replica of Mr. Noodle and is dressed as Mr. Noodle coming in on her day off. And it was just amazing. But yeah, so many. So what you saw about like the kind of visual echoes, we have the couple in bed in the initial breakup scene. And then I guess this is a spoiler, but later on we reprise that overhead shot and a kind of, I guess, karmic retribution occurs, an echo of that. But also there's a third one when the camera is pointed over the bed of Chester when he makes his first call to see Kitty, the first sex worker. So I had the angle of Chester looking over at the book that he was reading that gave him advice on how to hire a sex worker and the newspaper with Kitty's name highlighted there. So it's almost like, oh, Kitty's now the new kind of possible romantic, you know, liaison. So like visual repurposings.
Yeah. It was very like for me as a viewer, especially there was like when I noticed in those there's colors as well, like there was green and blue, I feel like. And I just watching it, I was like, oh, that's from earlier. And that was really, really fun to watch. I guess, how did you find yourself represented on screen? Like by, what's his name?
Dan Byrne.
Yes.
I was very happy with Dan's performance. Sukyun did include me for some of the auditions, but she did not include me at all in choosing the actor.
Yeah, so the ones that I did include, like I hired, it was important for me to hire sex positive artists and people with a nuanced understanding of consensual sex work in order to do the sex worker roles. And so I reached out to my community of like activists, musicians, performance artists, stand-up comedians, friends of mine, and they were non-actors. So I brought Chester in to work with the actors because they're non-actors, and he would, through this process, read the lines opposite, and we just would rehearse in my house. And so, yeah, I involved him there. And then I also had to write a letter to ACTRA for leniency. Normally, they would demand that I would hire all ACTRA actors. And that would mean I would have to cast people that had no understanding or no empathy or nuance for that perspective, which I can't do. Because in this day and age, it really is important that who tells a story is key. So, luckily, they agreed, and so they said, "Yes, you can do that. You can cast in that way, but every single other role you have to get ACTRA." So yeah, then I didn't include you at all in that perspective.
Right. But I was totally happy with the choice of Dan, and apparently there were a bunch of. Did you see something like 50 actors trying out for the Chester?
No, like over 100, like so many people for the Chester and Sonny roles. And only two of the actors that I had seen imbibe Chester with the qualities that I know and love about Chester. Those same words spoken by another actor would make him look like a jerk. Like a lot of people kind of interpret him as a jerk, which is really weird because he's like the opposite of a jerk. He's like so wonderful and sweethearted. And so there were two people that were like that. And when I saw Dan was a big fan of the graphic novel. And also his audition, he really made a compelling argument. He didn't look like a lunatic. He was like, you know, saying, okay, this is why, and this is why I'm doing this. And he made sense to me. Plus, he had such a sweethearted feeling. Plus, he said to me, "Sukyun, I really want this role. Full frontal's no problem for me. And also, if you want me to shave my head, I will." He just really wanted the part. So when I brought him together with Emily, and again, I saw many actors for Emily, who plays Sunny, who's my alter ego. And Sunny, she has to come from a truly alternative culture background. And that's something you can't fake. If you take somebody super mainstream and make them, you know, pretend they're alternative, it looks like super phony baloney. So like, I look at the two of you and I understand, yes, it's inherently in your bones. You can't fake that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So she really truly comes from a sort of alternative culture space. And then when I brought them together and they weren't even in the same city and they couldn't even see each other, they were on Zoom. They were so beautiful together. And they even like at one point, Emily and Dan pass a book. And they somehow passed the book perfectly from screen to screen. And I was like, how did you do that? And then also they just had a tremendous amount of care and tenderness between them. And that's the heart of the story. Like if you were to describe the events, most people go, what? That sounds terrible. You know. But the truth of the matter is we're friends, we're best friends, and we care about each other. And that care, without the care, it's not the movie.
Of course, yes. It bled across really well on screen. Their chemistry together as actors, and that was really fun to watch.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the scenes, I was about to say the scenes with Dan and Andrea playing Denise, the sex worker character. But now that I'm thinking about it, Dan's scenes with all the sex worker characters were terrific. And particularly, I thought, Leah Rose Sebastianis did a terrific job as the first sex worker that the Chester character sees.
Hanya Chang as Anne.
Yes, Hanya Chang as
and then the cartoonist friends, Eli Henry, he came up from Los Angeles, Chris Sandiford, and then also a different kind of departure from the graphic novel is I added a fourth cartoonist, Laura, who's sort of an amalgamation of Nina Bunjevic, Chester's friend, who's a cartoonist, and Jillian Tamaki, who's a friend of mine, who's a great cartoonist. So like instead of just having three guys, sort of throw in a fourth cartoonist who's a woman who we see the trajectory of like a sort of male dominated underground scene. And then we see as time goes by, she sort of rises to the top and is a star. So, you know, little small things like that. There was a sort of trajectory in Much Music too, the sort of increasing corporatization that makes my character quit. So there's like little small sort of other undercurrents throughout that.
Yeah, I don't know how well you know the comic scene, but I'm shown with my cartoonist friends. Chris Sandiford plays the character in the movie. He's called Kane, but he's based on this real life cartoonist named Seth, who's quite well known in the comics community. And then Eli Henry plays Cecil, who
is inspired by Joe Matt.
Yeah.
Another real life cartoonist.
I might age myself a little bit here of how young I am, but I think Seth illustrated a Lemony Snicket.
You're correct.
Yeah. So that I always, there's like a mystique to his persona the back of those books. And I remember that quite vividly as a child.
Neat.
So,
wonderful.
Yeah. That's my, I guess, knowledge of the cartoonist scene. But yeah.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. Like Chester was. He's like, you got to be careful, Sukyan. Just be prepared that people are going to hate this movie. Because, you know, you were, from your experience, people have been very anti-sex work positive. And I think maybe, the movie's been very well embraced so far. And there might have been time for people to reconfigure notions. I mean, it's still appalling, the lack of human rights afforded by our laws. But in terms of cultural, you know, where the temperature is, we're actually being able to, you know, entertain or consider these ideas with a bit more depth. But, you know, there are going to be like his rabid fans who are like, what? You weren't so big in his book? Or why is it, why did you incorporate, you know, I don't know. So far, it's been pretty good.
Yeah. I'm surprised at how positive the feedback and the reaction has been.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. Like Valerie Scott, who is the sex work activist, she said, you know, you can be, you can go to demonstrations, you can be an academic, you can fight in the Supreme Court of Canada. But she says, strangely, a simple, warm-hearted movie about, you know, relationships and is sex work positive has a lot more traction.
Yeah, there's definitely like weight that can be held with movie or film is such an easy concept, I think, for people, like nor everyday people to watch. And I really hope that it does have that ability to spark a conversation, at least to change stuff, because like it's so important to make sure that we're protecting people that need to be protected. And yes, I think your movie did a wonderful job of that.
So, oh, thanks. Yeah. I mean, the only obstacle we have right now is the disarray of the movie industry. And so everything has to be super big budget, superhero stars in order to even get your foot in the door. So that leaves out a lot of independent stuff. But like this movie was made by a village of peers and neighbors. Literally, I reached out to my neighbors to shoot in their place. I shot in my house where the real life events took place. I cast my friends. And so hopefully as there seems to be a burgeoning kind of indie movie world that is very kind of underground, but hopefully like people will spread the word, and seeing it at festivals and just having you come and talk to us is very helpful.
Yeah, of course. How has that festival, has the festival circuit been going for you so far? I know it premiered at TIFF.
Yeah, I mean, it's festivals have really downsized. And in the last few years since COVID and also the actors strike, they really got badly hit. A lot of sponsors are pulling out, so it's really hard going for a lot of artists these days. And as a filmmaker, I learned pretty soon that not to have my hopes up in terms of like where the movie will land. So I tried my hardest just to focus on making as good of a movie as I could and let my producers tell me where it lands. In the past, I've been like very hopeful, like, oh, I hope it goes here. I hope it goes here. And then had my hopes dashed. So I thought, kill hope, just deliver the best movie you can. And then when they called me and said, oh, it's like in this very prestigious program at TIFF, I was like very, very happy. It helps definitely for a launch. It's kind of, TIFF is like how you described it, kind of very energetic, and there's a lot of hype.
Yeah. The night of the premiere, I met with someone who works, one of my publishers, and we were going to go to the premiere together, and he just commented about how much energy that seemed to be on the street in front of the TIFF Lightbox building, and just energized us.
Yeah, it's definitely that helped to have the launch at TIFF. And then because a lot of festivals go, oh, what screened at TIFF? And then so suddenly the next thing I'm doing is like, then I'm going to, you know, Halifax for the Atlantic International Film Festival. And then Calgary, I just got back from Calgary. We're going to VIFF, going to Windsor and Sudbury, and then also Newfoundland. And yeah, so it's like boom, boom, boom. It just sort of hit right across Canada. So Canada, we're good. Canada, people seem to know me and seem to be receptive. We just, on the 11th hour, got a sales agent in Paris whose job is to sort of proliferate it around the world. So here's hoping it gets in Europe. I know, I understand Chester's a bit of an art star in Italy and Spain and France. And so hopefully they can run like that. And Short Bus was a big deal. I was an actor in this sort of LGBTQ plus, 2+, movie from some years ago. It was directed by John Cameron Mitchell, who is our executive producer. And that was a big splashy movie. And so hopefully those things will be somewhat on the radar of indie people, you know, outside of Canada.
Fingers crossed.
I know. Fingers crossed.
I was just interested to know what your collaboration was on the movie. We've talked about it a little bit, but just if you guys could touch on that a little bit more.
Yeah, sure. So like Chester is a very autonomous artist. He really is extraordinary in that he doesn't ask for a lot of feedback, really only spelling, because that's his weakness. He's not a very good speller. But other than that, he just makes his thing and then procures this masterpiece. So he's very silo person. And so, you know, he gave me the okay to do his thing, but he didn't necessarily contribute to the ideas and so forth. He was very particular about what he didn't. I would share, you know, drafts with him, and he'd say, this is good. This isn't quite, you know, this wouldn't happen. So I would, he offered to be a sounding board, much like Andrea Wehrhahn. So the actual making of it, the writing of it, I kind of had to. That's why it took so long. Sometimes I'd be like, okay, I got it. Okay, I got to take a break from it, ignore it for a couple of years, revisit it. So it really took time to sort of adapt to making it feel like authentic and have veracity. But then finally, when it was right on the page, and it seems like whenever anything's right on the page, that's when the financing comes. And so, boom, we got financing. I was like, what? And then they're like, yeah, you have 20 days to shoot it. Like, what? Geez, I've been slowly, you know, gardening and raising this script for years, and then boom, we have this tiny window. So yeah, it just had to be real quick, run and gun. I had to like really come up with a shot list and know exactly what I needed, design a movie that fit in terms of not too much coverage, and I basically cast all of the locations as I would actors. So essentially reaching out to places in my community, my former boss, Moses Neimer, who hired me at Much Music, he let me shoot at his TV station on a weekend, pulled in all the favors I could. And then still, it was really challenging. Like, so, you know, afterwards, looking at the footage and seeing there was a bunch of stuff that was missing. So then I was like, okay, Chester, can you be in it? Like, so I went over to his place and shot in his apartment to get pickup shots. And everything you see, all of the hands of Dan drawing, that's all Chester. Chester has a cameo, and he does all of the beautiful opening credits and like drawings. So, you know, in terms of, he really added his special spice into the movie.
Yeah, I was on set a couple days during the shoot. It was quite a few days. But for me, it was just fun. Like, I was just, you know, hanging out and watching everything, and it was lots of fun. And I would see Suk In, and it would seem, I was like, oh, thank God I'm not in that role. It looks so stressful. Like, but so I was not, the pressure wasn't on me. It wasn't my film. It's Suk In's film, definitely.
Yeah, a lot of pressure. A lot of there's a bunch of behind the scenes photos, and my brow was always furrowed because I'm always trying to problem solve. You know, there's a period of time where, yeah, just like every day, a new bump that you have to like figure out how to fix in the moment.
Perfect. Thank you guys so much for joining me today. It is my honor to speak to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us on your show.
Yes, thank you, Django.
Lebanon is facing a deep humanitarian crisis with nearly 1.2 million people displaced. In response, Lebanese diaspora and friends have organized a silent auction to raise funds for mutual aid initiatives on the ground, providing essential aid like food, sanitary products, and emergency shelter. You can bid via app.galabid.com/van2LEBANON. The auction will close at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Time on Friday, October 11th. Or if you're interested in donating funds, you can reach out today via email at Vancouver2@Lebanon.gmail.com. Experience the world of education this Saturday, October 26th at the Vancouver Convention Center. You can meet with top universities, graduate schools, and professional schools from Canada and around the world. Register online to stay up to date and check in at the fair to be eligible for prizes, including a free flight to anywhere in the world on Air Canada. Explore your future with Study and Go Abroad this October 26th by registering now at studyandgoabroad.com/Vancouver/. studyandgoabroad.com/Vancouver/.
Okay, welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Arts Report. I'm Serena. I'm in the studio with Lily, Django, and Cooper. And you just heard Django's interview with Sukyin Lee. Do you want to just tell us a little bit more about some other VIF stuff?
Yeah, so a few other things I saw. I saw one other thing. It was a soundtrack to a coup d'etat about...
Actually, you, me, and Cooper went to that together.
Yeah, we did.
So that's,
yeah.
That's perfect.
Super, super sick. But it was about the CIA's... and the Belgian government's coup on the Congo, and how there was a nice, like, kind of metaphoric draw between jazz music at the time, and there was direct links as well with, like, Louis Armstrong being used as, like, a CIA propaganda tool, pretty much, and, like, in Africa, which was, like, really crazy and cool to learn about.
I feel like, honestly, that was one of the best documentaries I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
Like, going into it, it was, like, 2.5 hours, but I was, like... raptured the whole time.
And it was,
super, so
like, quick pace and, like, really had you.
Well
the
done.
Music, too, was awesome.
Yeah, obviously the soundtrack to the coup d'etat was really well done. I do super want to get into this more, but I think that that's going to have to wait until the next episode. So it's looking like a little bit of our VIF stuff is going to kind of spill over.
To
the episode on the 30th, but that's okay. anyways, but we do have another interview coming up here that our good friend Ava did with Clara at VOAF, which is the Vancouver Outsider Arts Festival. So this past weekend, Ava attended the VOAF Art Festival at the Roundhouse Community Arts and Recreation Center. She was able to attend on Friday evening, the opening night of the festival. The turnout was amazing, and the community center was packed with a wide range of people across all ages and backgrounds. Spent most of her evening walking around exploring the exhibit. Because it was opening night, there was a lot of artists that were present to their collection, and it was great to watch them similarly explore the exhibit. Ava feels she was lucky enough to spend the evening asking the artists lots of questions and gaining a more intimate understanding of their work. In particular, she had an incredible impromptu interview with Clara Lepo, a visual artist who tackles painful themes with childlike wonder and excitement. Clara primarily uses paint pens on various surfaces to create intricate patterns, and more information about their work is on the VOAF website. So thank you so much, Ava. Here is that interview.
Catch California noise artists TVMA and Andrew Wayne as they bring their West Coast tour to Green Auto on Wednesday, October 16th. Joined by local favorites, Two Girls, One Daw, Tough Cell, Before At, and Libra Baby. Don't miss this night of genre-blurring electronic music by queer and trans artists. Doors at 7 p.m. and music at 8 p.m. Tickets are $10 online via Green Auto's Eventbrite or $15 at the door. Masks required. Can't wait to see you there.
So hi, I'm here with a lovely artist at the Vancouver Outsiders Art Festival. Do you want to introduce yourself just briefly?
Yeah, I'm a visual artist. I use mostly paint pens. My name's Clara Aleppo. I don't know what else I should say.
So what particularly made me want to interview you is I felt like you had such cohesion in the exhibit that you put together. And I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about like your vision. I can only imagine how long that setup must have taken you. You had such like good layering.
I really appreciate that question because it's like very rich. So I mentioned before you turned the tape on that I had made the decision to try and make an exhibition catalog about a fake exhibition that never happened. And I made up like an alternate version of a famous French art gallery. I like messed with the spelling and the logo. So for the last like couple of months or something, I've been like driven to get this thing done. And it was a series that I had been working on in 2021 when I was like homeless and then living in an SRO. And it was like a time full of like violence, and it was during the pandemic, and it was so at some point I had to like quarantine my stuff because it got infested with bed bugs and everything I'd been working on, because I just escaped an abusive situation. So like it was hard, but at the same time I was making all this stuff because I was free to just do things. It got locked down in a thing for 2 years so it would decontaminate, and I was like really sort of traumatized about it and never knew if I'd finish it or not, but it was very dear to my heart. When I thought up doing this book, it was like suddenly I could finish it. Like stuff I'd been staring at for years that I was like, oh, I wish that was done, just was getting done like in a day, like flying off the presses kind of thing. And so it's coherent the way it is for a couple of reasons. One, because I put those big textiles in behind, and that just creates sort of the illusion of logic where maybe there isn't. But the other reason is because I wanted that, what I call the meal ticket series, which is the one I was talking about, I wanted it to be sort of the main event. So everything else is kind of configured to give context. Unfortunately, the book never got printed because the printing press broke down. The company couldn't, was pretty late with it, but anyway, so that didn't work. Like people can't flip through the thing and look at the context and understand why it's like that, or it would have been on the table and people could have read through it. But I wanted to kind of have everything else configured so that people could see like, where did this come from, where did it go after, there's a whole arc there. So kind of moved from like, I used to do anthropology, which wasn't a great situation, but that's another story. But like it was, I went pretty far in it and did like almost a PhD and stuff, got a master's in like the UK. So it used to be about cultural patterns. It was very intricate, almost like an illuminated manuscript, but quite uptight too. Went to this abstract stuff when I was free and sort of exploded all over the place with colors and weird lines. And then it ended up in this landscapey, because I started being able to like connect with Native community finally. I was adopted by white people, but I'm Native. So finally I started getting that like religious aspect and stuff. And it started turning into landscape. Mm-hmm. So there's like a before and after of the story of the main thing I wanted to showcase that's like flowing through.
Because one thing that I was going to ask you about actually is I felt that, I was really curious when you started to develop your like style, because it's so stylized. And I was wondering just a bit more about the timeline and how you've curated the identity with your art that you have now. And I think you were starting to talk about that where after you kind of broke away from anthropology, but
well,
maybe you don't see it.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
No, please.
I was still doing a lot of art before. Like I started doing it in high school, but the thing is I was in an abusive familial situation. So I didn't think I was allowed to do art. So I never used, I still don't use a paintbrush or like I wouldn't know how. I use these paint pens because when I started, it was just ballpoint school pens. So I'd get all these patterns that were just one color. And then I was like, well, I have a red pen today. Maybe I'll try and work with red and black. But like I limited myself to one, two, or three colors for the first 15 years of doing stuff.
Wow.
And when I was about like 22, 23, 15, okay, not, probably wasn't doing it when I was five, but like, you know, I was doing it as long as I can remember. And when I was about 23, 24, I started getting a few more colors. And then by the time I was in my late 20s, I was up to about 17, and it stayed at 17 for a long time. But the problem was they were pens. They weren't, so they would light fade. Mm. They can't be exhibited. This is fine because it's only a couple of days, but like they lose all their color. So I couldn't show them. They just piled up. So I'm sorry if I'm rambling, and do like cut me
off. No, I am curious. So what are you working with now? Because you mentioned those were pens. So what's your current process?
You saw what I was doing, right? They're still pens, but they're pens with real paint inside. So they're light fast. You can use it like a pen, but you're using paint. Mm-hmm. So it looks still like it's a pen and ink drawing, but you can have any color you want. Mm-hmm. And it's light fast, and it's, it looks like painting, but it has that different quality to it, I think, because I'm still thinking like someone who's using pens, and I'm still thinking like someone who has finite and discrete colors and isn't blending or mixing. No.
I mean, that's so interesting to imagine that you started off with just one color, one, two colors for so long, because looking at your art now, it's so vibrant. Like, it's color is the first thing you see. Like, my gosh, I think it's probably the most colorful exhibit there. Yeah.
It was a pendulum swinging the other way thing. Like, because for so long I had this sort of nasty, not true narrative that like you're like not good enough to have colors or whatever. Mm-hmm. When that broke, when I was like, oh, that's just bad mental health. That's nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you were. Then I was like, well, I'm gonna just take everything and just slam it up on the wall.
I mean, looking at your exhibit, to me, it just looks like an explosion of creativity. It's. I feel like I really see what you're saying.
I think that is what happened. Like, I was in a terrible situation with no agency or freedom, even though, like, I was doing a PhD, I was doing anthropology from the outside. I was completely controlled by my family. And one day, I, like, said no, stood up for myself too many times, and suddenly I was homeless. And although that was traumatic and stressful, they couldn't, like, stop me from doing stuff like art then. And also, there was a need to deal with the trauma. So the other side of the color that I think might be a little bit darker, but also...
it's maybe the story we need to hear sometimes, yeah.
Or like, something we find uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Somebody was asking me, there is the other, like a reporter for, I think, City TV or something was asking me this earlier today, and I didn't realize. There's a picture there called Terminus in the bottom corner with a really big frame. It's about when I was on my grandmother's deathbed. I was alone. I hadn't slept for several days.
You can take a moment.
It's spam. I was helping my partner. She was getting evicted, and we were up all for days trying to sort that out. Then I get the call, my grandmother's dying. My family wouldn't come to the deathbed. I was alone. I couldn't leave. We were very, like, that was the only family member that was safe, that I was close to, that cared about me. And so the process of being alone with someone who's dying, anybody would think, oh, that's really bad, negative stuff. What's the upshot, right? There is no upshot, but by doing the art, you go, wait a second. There's more here. Like, there's this little crack that, like, I imagine her kind of consciousness going through, and there's this kind of fizzing going down the drain of it, like death, and slowly the being sort of drains out. You start thinking about it and go like, okay, that's horrible, and I love her and I miss her, and it was like a terrible experience. But that's wild. Like, life and death is wild and vast and beyond our comprehension. And when you do art with a traumatic thing, you don't just get the trauma. You can, I mean, you can paint a really dark thing, but like, you have the option to just the other elements that are a bit awkward, like wonder, like, there was life, now there isn't, how is this possible? Like, that just visceral childlike wonder of like how the universe works. Same with violence, or just questions like, why would someone do that to me? Like, why is it like this? Why is that piece too? The main piece I'm trying to showcase the series is about, like, why is the economy like this? Why is finance like this? But there's a playful aspect too. There's so much that's arbitrary and even silly about it. The faces people put on their banknotes, the like weird little phrases that like, if they didn't belong to a state, people would get laughed at and bullied for being like weird and quirky and cliquey about it. Like, just if you have power, suddenly all your weird quirks matter. And there's something kind of funny and even amiable about that. And if you're using art, you're wrestling with that oppression, you're wrestling with that difficulty, but you're allowed to kind of laugh at it too, especially if it's happening to you. Like, no one can get mad at me for laughing about the funny side of homelessness if I'm being homeless while it's happening, right? It'd be different if I was sitting in a comfy armchair.
Yeah.
But same with death. Like, I couldn't laugh about it. Well, it wasn't funny. It was something different. It was actually, like, I don't know. It's all the emotions.
Yeah.
Like, too many blended to parse them apart. Obviously, like, it was one of the low points of my life and da-da-da, but, like, I guess I'm trying to say, like, the color can be a way of going, like, some of these moments of trauma that you're doing art to get yourself through, to just distract yourself, to take what you've experienced and get it somewhere else so you can look at it when you need to and put it away when you can't handle it. That process taps into something so vivid that I think it needs color. I think it needs just really loud color. Because, like, when we're going through every day and we're in our, like, rhythm and whatever, things look a bit dull, they look a bit grayscale, we're not really, you know, and we're all mostly like that, take the bus, walk down the street, pay the taxes, whatever, like, you're just kind of...
just going through the motions.
Yeah, and then if you look for a sec, like, if we just stop right now and go, like, okay, you and me both have a pulse, that's happening now, that's going to stop one day, we're both breathing, and we both know that that's not going to last forever, and we have no idea what's going to happen afterwards. We're here, like, right now, we have this right now. That's insane. Like, there's something totally insane about that. It's scary, and if but it's also beautiful, and it's like if you start trying to, like, parse out, like, just how precious is that, like, this second, right now, right now, and it's gone. Like, if I say I'm going to snap my fingers and you know I'm actually going to do it and you know it's coming, it's in the future. The second I do it, it'll be gone. And you won't even be able with your consciousness to notice the exact moment. It's gone. It's in the past. It'll never happen again quite the same way. That's insane to me. And so I feel like color is a way, it's almost like gratitude too. Like, it's a way to go, like, this is more... there's an aspect of this that is more beautiful than I could possibly do justice to. And that used to really bother me. And suddenly it's become very humbling and meaningful. Like, I